Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Soleri Report. In fact, this is going to be a joint Dreamland Soleri Report conversation with Whitley Strieber, New York Times bestselling author. Whitley, you've had so many books on the New York Times bestseller list, I don't even pretend to know how many it is. But Whitley is the host of Dreamland, a wonderful website. If you haven't visited, I suggest you check it out. And he's someone, I think, who spent more time looking at and trying to understand reality than just about anyone I know. It's really a pleasure to know him and be in cahoots with him and his wife, Anne. And I asked Whitley to take a look at our annual report because, you know, we're very interested here at the Soleri Report, and, you know, me personally, but on behalf of all the subscribers of, you know, the world is whatever the world is. How do we have a free and inspired life? And so it combines looking at the world as it really is and trying to understand it as it really is for the point of navigating it so we can be happy and enjoy our lives. So we're doing everything we can to avoid the doom and gloom, folks. Anyway, Whitley, so you're someone who certainly spent a lifetime trying to have a free and inspired life. So I really appreciate your reading the annual wrap-up and taking time to join us on the Soleri Report, so welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So why don't I let you lead off? Because what I tried to do in the annual wrap-up is we try to go through the environment and provide people with a framework on what's going on. You know, the world seems so bizarre. And it's very hard at this point as you look at sort of the official, you know, the official story is so far from reality that it makes it very bizarre to wander through life trying to navigate the world as it is versus the official reality. So so that was my best shot at a framework. So why don't I just turn it over to you and say, what do you think?
Well, you know, what I think is this. I'll get to some outliers in a few minutes, and one of which is actually mentioned in your report, that which is parallel universes, is a very interesting, some very interesting stuff to talk about there. Before that, though, I'd like to take just a bit of a moment to look at the way the world around us is changing physically in terms of the environment, because some important things are happening. To be specific, in terms of the U.S. economy, the single most important thing that's happening is that the Pacific Ocean's warming pattern, which could be cyclical, there's a certainly indication from the past that it is, that this has happened fairly regularly. In fact, it happened back in the 14th century. But this warming pattern is going to cause the west coast of the United States to experience a protracted drought. I mean protracted. It could last 25 years, 50 years even, which the last one lasted over 100 years in this region. And if that's the case, then, well, my first piece of advice is don't buy a house right now on the west coast. My second piece of advice is if you have one you're interested in selling, now would probably be a better time to do it than 5 years from now. The problem is that there has been no advanced planning for this because it's such a long cycle. In other words, the powers of government, which probably should have been planning for this starting 25 years ago, didn't have the foresight to do it, and how could they sell this to the public? Because it would have taken, to begin, two things. First, it would have required an analysis of water use into the future and the degree to which it can be supported by desalinization. And then, as the drought set in, the building of plants, desalinization plants. That hasn't happened. The second thing is that well drilling should have been much more carefully regulated in California than it has been, The actual truth is that there are thousands of wells in this state that the state doesn't even know exist, that are perfectly legal. And over a large part of the central part of California, it's been possible for many years to poke a hole in the ground and get a lot of water out. Unfortunately, that water table is going to drop precipitately. And then you have the big cities, primarily Los Angeles and San Francisco, that are so dependent on runoff from the Sierras, from the mountains. They're not going to get that starting this year, and they may not get it again for many years to come. That's a problem, and this is something we're going to have to look at. The other side of the ocean, the Gulf Stream, is slowing down, as it has been for many years, but the process has increased significantly recently, with the result that the jet stream, the air currents, are also changing. And the reason that the jet stream has wobbled and dropped down over the central United States is that the Gulf Stream is no longer pushing it. The western arm of the Gulf Stream is no longer pushing it and holding it north the way it used to. The unexpected consequence is that the Arctic is getting warmer, and you would think that as it pulled away from the sun, that wouldn't have happened, but in fact it did. The next thing that will happen with as this process continues are two things. One has already started, which is a decline in air circulation over the northern hemisphere. Paris recently became the most polluted city on Earth, beating out Beijing by a country mile. And the reason that air circulation over Europe is declining, and this is because the Gulf Stream,
over the entire northern hemisphere, or just over North America.
Over the entire northern hemisphere. This will be I'm talking about a hemispheric event, and this is likely to continue. It is hard to tell if these two things are related, or even if they have anything direct to do with global warming. But we're at the end of an interglacial. It's lasted about 15,000 years. The last glaciation collapsed about 15,000 years ago under circumstances that really mirror the world we're living in now. So we could theorize or even say that human emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere sped the process up or intensified it. But it was going to happen anyway. And this has been my mantra since 1983, if you can believe it, 85 rather, when I published Nature's End, that this is going to happen. We need to start planning for it, and we're just not doing that. Instead, we're debating essentially the degree to which human interference is affecting something that's going to happen anyway. No matter what we do, we can't stop this. That's what
I
Nobel
find
will
the
face.
Hardest. I find the hardest topic. To build a clear, coherent map about is both sort of space weather changes, Earth changes. What's happening geophysically to the planet?
The planet's it's a very complex situation. There is a degree of solar influence that, unfortunately, we don't understand because the changes in solar output are so small. It's difficult to understand how those tiny changes in energy could have profound effects on planet Earth, but something does. We've been in and out of ice ages now for nearly 3 million years. This planet has had periods of, looking back over the geologic history of planet Earth, the great bulk of that time, it did not have frozen poles at all. Over vast, vast amounts of its lifespan, there has been essentially no ice of any significance on planet Earth. It's been a warm, very quiet, very humid climate environment. And this is why these long, long periods of time grew so many large and complex animals. Like the dinosaurs or the fauna of the previous period prior to the Paleolithic, the Mesozoic. And the now, though, for this period of time, something changed. There are some theories that Earth's axis tilt was an effect, that there was no, the planet was not in the same position prior in relation to the sun as it is now. There's some thought that the rising of the Central American land, which interrupted an enormous transoceanic current that was very stabilizing to climate and evened out temperature all over the planet, maybe that had an effect. Maybe there's something changing in the sun. Maybe, for example, we're going through an area of space in which there is more dust than there has been for all of these millions and millions of years, and therefore solar output varies when we go into a thicker dust cloud. But these things are not random. In other words, an ice age lasts about 100,000 years, then it snaps into a interglacial of 15,000 years, then back into another ice age. So, in other words, it's not something random. It's something cyclical, a new cycle of some kind that has evolved. And unfortunately, we have drowned out the efforts, and they are there among scientists, to determine what this cycle is and how it works and how it's going to affect us in the global warming debate. Because the people on one side don't want to hear anything about any kind of climate change. And on the other side, they want to shout down anyone who says this might be have anything to do with a natural cycle. But it does. It does.
Well, there are many people who say we're coming into a new ice age.
We are. Absolutely. We are. In the next couple of thousand years, the planet's going to get colder, I can assure you, no matter what happens. Let me explain the way this usually works, the way it worked the last time. What happens is, for unknown reasons, the Arctic warms, and there is a release of energy in the form of methane, which is released from the tundra and permafrost and from methane hydrates that are frozen at 47 degrees Fahrenheit along the continental shelves. The release of this methane, and there's also generally a lot of carbon dioxide and pollutants, because in the past this has been accompanied by volcanic activity, which may start there, and I can tell you why that happens in just a minute. In any case, the methane release causes two things to happen. One, there are atmospheric flares, and these flares can be very dangerous, and they have, in the past, it appears, set whole regions of the planet on fire, forest fires. The second thing is methane is a very powerful heat retention agent, and the planet heats up very rapidly. The ice collapses. The oceans increase in the amount of weight of water on the continental shelves increases fantastically, almost, with the result that there's a lot of volcanism develops. And when that happens, there is an immediate increase in the amount of air pollution, carbon dioxide. So the planet does what's happening now on its own, without us. It has a mechanism that will do this. Then the methane dissipates. There is a sudden change in the climate regime. There is suddenly a lot of snow over the northern hemisphere, and there comes a summer when the snow in the northern hemisphere doesn't melt, because the reflectivity of this very widespread snowpack is so great, and the absence of methane in the atmosphere is so sudden that a lot more heat is radiated out than has been before, and a new cold regime starts. Once we have a single summer without ice melt across parts of the northern hemisphere, across, say, central and northern Canada, if that happens, then you know another ice age will come, is started. That will be the signal.
Right.
And it could happen the way things are going. It's not going to happen today, But if we have a methane spike, and it looks like that is, in fact, starting, then we're going to go through a period of profound change. Our concern is not going to be the ice. Our concern is going to be a spike in heat in the planet, planetary atmosphere, that has not been expected in any global warming scenarios that I know of, because they were built around the idea that this was all human caused, and therefore anything that suggested otherwise was ignored, for political reasons, I think. So you basically have two sets of politicians, the global warming politicians and the no climate change politicians, yelling at each other about a problem that they are both completely misstating. In fact, if we see more methane emitting this summer, then it's time, in terms of thinking about investment, to think in terms of longer-term investment in certain commodities which are going to become scarce with climate change, because they're in fragile supply if there is a profound change in the weather. And by that, of course, I refer to the grain complex and such similar food commodities. Probably not rice, because this is actually going to increase the monsoon. It could create, however, a situation where there is profound monsoonal flooding in rice-growing areas. So that could be a factor, too. In terms of the way we live, we can expect that there will be more chaos in areas of the world that are very dependent on imports of basic food supplies. I refer now to the Middle East, which the Middle East, as you know, the so-called Arab Spring, which was actually the return of the Arab Dark Ages. How I laughed when I saw that media crowing about an Arab Spring. Good Lord, that was the very last thing that was going to happen. In any case, it was triggered by a food crisis that was in turn triggered by a drought in Russia and the Ukraine, and they basically stopped exporting wheat, upon which the Middle East depends absolutely on Russian and Ukrainian wheat for its food. The basic food in the Middle East is a flatbread made of wheat. They can't live without it. It's essential. And when they began to get hungry, they took to the streets. And that has been the history of mankind. Yeah. Or rather, the history of... Go ahead.
Let me just step back. So if you look at investment over the last 50 years, we've seen the developed world suck a huge amount of money out of their own capital base, shift some of it into the emerging markets, but spend a fortune on the black budget, including underground facilities and building us to the point where we can be a multi-planet civilization. And you look at that, Whitley, and you say, is this the reason why? Are they, and I would say as part of that, in the last 20 years, we've seen a huge effort, well, from 1980 on, so the last 35 years, to pump and dump the farmers and consolidate control of the farmland and turn the U.S. into a sort of a juggernaut of food exports. Is what you're describing explain what's going on?
Let's look at the past 2 years in terms of farming. Year before last, there was a crisis in farming in the United States because of drought. Last year, there was a crisis in farming in the United States because of overproduction. So I don't see that the free market, that this particular area of human activity has escaped the free market or been drawn out of it at all. It's true that the complex's economic underpinnings have changed, but its dependence on the weather and the climate have not changed and cannot change. If there is such a thing.
Well, but what I'm saying is there's been a real effort to centralize ownership and control of farmland.
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course there has, because probably they're well aware of the fact that we're going to get into a situation in which the for example, they need to be able to turn off the export spigot with a single twist of a dial. They can't.
Right.
One thing that the United States will never allow, as long as it can, is for the American people to go hungry. And every country in the world has the same attitude. They will not export if we will not be able to eat as a result. And that could happen. We could, there could be, in sometime in the next presidency, that could be a decision that has to be made in the White House. And if they have no direct control over the market forces, that decision may be very hard to carry out. And that could be one of the reasons for all of this consolidation. The situation as it exists now on the ground is that we're going to have to adapt to a changing planet without the kind of planning that would have made this easy and safe. In point of fact, there's going to be another food crisis in the Middle East within the next 5 years, and probably a worse one. There's going to be food crises in other parts of the world. There could be a big food crisis in South America, which is a juggernaut of production, except that the place is in such a situation of drought that there are big cities in Brazil that, if this drought doesn't break, are going to have to be evacuated. We may see that later, as I've said, in California, and maybe what happens in Brazil will be a kind of wake-up call to the America, to the North Americans, because we could be facing the same thing here in a few years. So this is the kind of thing that we need to think about in terms of retaining wealth and growing wealth in a changing situation. There's no reason...
So Whitley, where does a person go to get clear, coherent understanding of what's happening with the weather and the planet?
I think that if it was the truth was simply being told, then it would be perfectly clear. We have to get to the point where it isn't one side saying there's no climate change and the other side saying it's all human caused, because neither one of these statements are true. For example, I listen often to a commodities weather analyst who keeps saying he doesn't believe in climate change and this is what the weather's going to be. And he's usually quite correct, but he won't be correct always because he's basically not, and I've written him emails about this, he's not actually predicting the weather. He's expressing an ideology. And ideologies don't tend to change things don't tend to change climate. The only way to do this is to figure it out for yourself. Or we have a thing on our website on unknowncountry.com called Climate Watch, which has been since it started about 10 years ago, it's been extremely accurate for the simple reason that I know what's really happening. It's not a secret, and it's not a secret to anybody, and not a secret to a lot of scientists. They just can't make themselves heard. What you need to watch, if you want to watch this, are two critical factors. The water temperature of the Pacific Ocean, especially the northern half of the Pacific Ocean, and the condition of the Gulf Stream. These two things will dictate what climate will be like in the United States and Canada, and in to a lesser extent, but still also in Europe. What I see when I look at these things is, as I've said, there's a much greater likelihood of a protracted drought in the western United States than there is of a return to the old regime. In the eastern half of the country, we can expect more intense winters, but interestingly enough, relatively less intense storm seasons in the spring and fall. And the reason for this is storms depend on air circulation to happen. Declining air circulation and warming of the stratosphere, which is also taking place, means that storms will be less frequent. But when you get a warning, watch out, because that storm is liable to expand very dramatically. This is because it has lifted above the stratosphere, and there's a line up there where the stratosphere is ending, and the temperature differential between the two areas is really great. So if a storm reaches up above the stratosphere, it's going to quickly become extremely intense. I think that's probably what happened to the AirAsia flight that broke up over a couple of weeks ago. That flight, the plane was in a very intense thunderstorm and apparently got grabbed by an updraft that our planes are simply not designed to handle, because there was no wind. There were no winds that powerful in the atmosphere when
this
they.
This isn't the one in Europe. This is the one in.
In Asia. It was over the. It was on its way out of Indonesia, and the pilot left the cockpit, and the co-pilot was left alone. When he was left alone, the plane went into a configuration that the computers weren't designed to handle, and they turned it over to him, and he couldn't handle it either. And the result was the plane broke up. What it went into was a very, very rapid ascent. It got caught in an updraft of a type that we don't see or expect on planet Earth, but we should expect them in the future. That would mean that if you're in an American carrier over the United States, you're not going to have to worry, because you will be vectored out of that. That will not happen. In an area like that where air traffic control is less efficacious and less efficient, a pilot's request, which they did make, to move to a smoother altitude might be ignored. And so it's more dangerous to fly in these circumstances in areas where these thunderstorms can blow up suddenly, like over the ocean in Asia, over the South China Sea, and so forth. I wouldn't worry too much.
Right, I've lived through monsoons in the South China Sea, and it's amazing.
Yeah. I wouldn't worry so much about it in Europe either, but even though their airspace is much more crowded than ours because it's a smaller area, they do have very good air traffic control. So I don't think you'd have to worry. And I suspect that most countries' meteorological services are aware of what happened to that plane and what can happen now and will act accordingly.
Well, clearly a decision has been made in the governance level to not be forthright with the general population about what's happening.
Government and forthright?
Yeah.
What? When has that ever been true? You know, back, I believe, in 1999, Walter Orr Roberts, who was the emeritus chairman of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, told me that the EPA was aware that there was going to be a great atmospheric and climatic crisis in planet Earth starting in about 20 years. And I said, well, why isn't that public knowledge? He said, because the information is too incendiary, and everybody who would have to put their career on the line to tell the truth is afraid to do that. And I think that's part of it. I think also part of it is when someone like a president is informed of something like this, they're going to say, well, if it's not certain, then I don't want to scare the public. There's another level, though, and it's darker. That is a level of where there are people in control of large amounts of capital and large amounts of wealth and ultimately also lives, who say to themselves, well, how do I preserve my capital and how do I preserve my life under these circumstances? And I think then you get to why all of these underground facilities are being built, why so many well-known names are buying property in the Altiplano in Central South America and Uruguay and Paraguay, because It's an area with still a very high water table. It's not very populated. And it's going to be one of the last areas where there is going to be dramatic climate change. And so they're going to run to those areas. Also, the low population means that it'll probably remain relatively stable as long as people don't starve. And that's, of course, an open question. So there are people who know and who are taking steps to save themselves. And in my very darkest place, I think to myself, there may be people out there who want this to happen because they feel that the population of the planet is too large and we will be better off with not billions of human beings on planet Earth, but a few hundred million. And they'd just as soon let this happen.
And
well, I'm from the Winston Churchill school, you know, tell the people, because I think that group genius can go to work on any challenge.
Absolutely.
If this, and I'm not convinced that, you know, the human race's response will be to be irresponsible. I find there's remarkable responsibility in the general population if they're confronted with the facts. So, you know, and I'm sympathetic to some of the risk managers. If you're, you know, what history says is you can't let your insurance industry go down.
Right.
And transparency around some of these issues could really threaten the insurance industry in a way which is not good for anybody. So, you know, you clearly, that there are very nuts and bolts practical reasons why you want sort of responsible heads to prevail.
Yes.
But I do think this thing is so big, Whitley, that you need group genius to go to work on it. And you can if everybody's running around, you know, embroiled in bread circus or gloom and doom.
Well, so, that's very true. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Because we've got bread and circus versus gloom and doom. And neither side is going to help us.
Right. It's all, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest loss of wealth on this planet is the waste of people's time. You know, and there's no greater time wasted than embroiled in completely false maps. One of my favorite maps, have you ever seen the map of the island of California?
No.
Oh, it's great. It's a 1500s map, and it developed and grew up in Spain where they showed the United States the western map. They showed California as an island. And so explorers would sail, and they would get to the coast of California, and they would disassemble their boats and literally carry them over the mountains so they could sail across the inlet of California. And, of course, they'd die in the desert. And a whole myth grew up around the court of Spain where explorers saying, oh, yes, you know, I sailed around the Isle of California.
How interesting.
That the map was correct. Everybody got so invested in the lie, and it took the king to say, kill the map. Because you were, you know, the lies were costing a fortune in money and lives. And so, you know, it's a wonderful story of how a bad map can just, you know, make a mess. But you have too many powerful people who are vested in the lies and don't want to admit that they've been lying all the, you know, they never sailed around the Isle of California because there's no such thing.
Well, you know, you're talking about a social response that's very common. People don't like to admit that they're wrong, and they also don't like to admit that they've lied even more than that.
Right.
Well, there were
kids. Well, but I'll never forget when I was on Wall Street, there was a very, very prominent and successful and extremely wealthy investor, and I would stay out in the Hamptons next to his property. And we would go off and just laugh about how ridiculous and silly the official reality was. And, you know, how the news, just the lies got worse and worse and worse. And it was a matter of some joke. And I'll never forget going back in 1997 and having lunch with him in New York. And suddenly I had this horrible feeling because I realized he had bought into the official reality and he'd forgotten.
Wow.
And, you know, it was almost as though we became a prisoner of our own lives. Does that make any sense?
Well, it happens to us when we, well, for example, going back even farther than the island of California, there was the kingdom of Prester John, which many people.
What's that?
Well, it was a kingdom in it didn't exist, was the problem it had. It was somewhere south of Ethiopia. And throughout the Middle Ages, it was believed in, and there were people who had said they had gone there and had met the people there, and there were descriptions of it and so forth. And it wasn't until really, really more serious exploration began that it was realized that it didn't exist. And people bought into it, and they built a, what they didn't realize was a legend around it. This is one of the dangers that we face now and that is actually happening, because we're building this kind of legend around the changing climate, which is not a true legend. It's false. And
right.
Because it's false, we're not going to be able to succeed in planning for anything correctly. It's unfortunate. But I want to go on if we can, because there are some very interesting outliers that I'd like to get to talking about a little bit. And, of course, being Whitley Strieber, I suppose I'm also supposed to talk about aliens, in which I have very little belief. I'm not at all certain there are aliens here. And I'll get into that, why that would
okay.
be the case, and why this all might have a great deal to do with our world and with changes that are happening directly on the ground. The first thing, and I just want to talk about this briefly, is that one of the things that we have always wondered about is whether or not there was such a thing as a soul, and does it exist outside of the body. There is a new model of consciousness called orchestrated objective reduction that was theorized by Sir Roger Penrose and a remarkable man, an anesthesiologist called Stuart Hameroff, which says that consciousness derives from fine-scale quantum activities inside cells, most prevalent of a type that are most prevalent in the brain's neurons. If this is true, and that it is not essentially an outcome of a vast amount of computation, if this is the case, then it is a non-computable quantum process, and it would not disappear. It's an energetic process that would persist in some way after the body dies. In other words, there would be a soul. Whether the soul
right.
would be as richly endowed with memory and so forth as the brain is an open question, but it would mean that we don't disappear when we die. And that's that. If that idea enters scientific theory, it's going to change the way we think about ourselves profoundly, because in the back of every mind, and this has always been true from the beginning, is the thought that maybe I'm just going to disappear when I die. If we know that is not true, that would be a fundamental change in the way we see ourselves, and it will change our history. Now, there's another thing going on. There is an experiment that is going to be performed at the Large Hadron Collider within a few months, assuming they get it online again, once they do, and that will tell us for certain whether or not parallel universes exist. If they do, then they are here, and we are separated from them by a very thin membrane, and it will turn out that we will be able, once we know it's there, to learn to affect that membrane. And this is why I say I'm so dubious about the alien hypothesis, because I think that they are there, and I think that others have learned to affect that membrane. And so the so-called aliens are not infinitely far away from us. They're infinitely close. That's the
right.
hilarious part of it. And they are learning, to a degree, to enter this reality. And it's very difficult, and it's very compromised when they do it, but it is obviously possible. And I think some kind of interaction between us and them on an official level has resulted in a gap leap in terms of technology, that there is a level of mankind that has access to truly extraordinary technology, and maybe even a presence off planet. I don't know, but this is what they is known as the breakaway civilization.
Right.
And I think that's a possibility. And I think if parallel universes are proved and it becomes common knowledge that there may be an extraordinary and unexpected intersection between us, the poor duffs who are struggling along in the ordinary civilization, still filling our flat tires with air, and the breakaway civilization. We might see a confluence there that might change things a great deal and very suddenly on planet Earth.
Right.
And for the better.
One of my big questions, Whitley, is to what extent the group that's maintaining and controlling this technology can continue to keep the rest of civilization from innovating into a lot of that new technology, or it's seeping out.
Well, what I'm saying is that will happen. If we realize the parallel universes are there and that resource exists in other universes that we can get into contact with, then I think that intersection will happen, that this level of humanity will begin to catch up with that level, and they will not be able to conceal themselves from us anymore.
It's funny, if you look at the cell tower technology and cell towers and smartphones, you know, I've believed that some of the dynamic behind the creation of that network relates to the last two things you said, which is, you know, if our soul is enduring, so if our soul is immortal, it's much harder to control. And, you know, I've often thought that the cell towers are trying to get us to resonate through the cell towers as opposed to with each other, you know, sort of on an immortal basis. That's number one. But number two, if there are these parallel universes, how in the world do you maintain control in a world where consciousness can shift in sudden and enormous, you know, it's the 100-monkey syndrome, the 6th monkey starts washing the banana, suddenly monkeys on other, islands are doing it. It's out of control. So how do you get an early warning system? Well, one way is just to have everybody have a smartphone and be watching what they're doing.
Interesting thought, indeed. When, you know, when we look at the future, and it looks to say the least, extremely complex over the next 25 years, and growing more so, and it's kind of scary. But let's look way back. Let's look back to before the last ice age, over 100,000 years ago, where we were then. We were naked. We had rudimentary language. We had fire. We were hunter-gatherers, most of us living in Africa, some of us living farther north. The ice age came. We went through absolute living hell. As that ice age ended, we began to mythologize about our world. That's when where the flood myths come from, and all of the dire myths that reflect the end of that period when the ice was melting. Out of that ice age, though, there came social organization. We were clothed. We had more complex language. Homo sapiens had melded with what other species of human were around and had become a single species. And we walked on into the sunlit uplands of the interglacial, which is ending now. We will evolve again and in surprising ways. And the reason I brought up the new ideas of the soul is one of the ways we are going to evolve, and this comes from my own life experience, is that this veil, this mysterious veil between the worlds, behind which we have lived all of our history, is going to fall, and we are going to discover that we're not small, little creatures creeping across a planet for a brief space and then gone, but long, immortal beings with very, very different lives than we can see through the medium of the brain. And when we understand ourselves in this new way, something I call the new man is going to emerge. And among those people listening to this right now, some of you will be new men. I don't know who, but some will, because some of you will live long enough to go into the pressure of the collapse of this planetary environment, which is mankind going down the birth canal. Earth is pregnant with mankind. We're going down the birth canal. Of course it's hard, but there are all kinds of midwives here and all kinds of weird things happening. That's what all these UFOs and stuff are about. I don't think they'd be around if they didn't expect a live birth. I certainly do. I'd like to now turn to another outlier, something that was released from the captivity of classification back in 2006, very quietly, called the Condyne Report. It's not the Condon Report. It's a play on words, C-O-N-D-I-G-N. And it's possible to, will be possible shortly to go on my website and read the whole thing, because it was released by the Ministry of Defense in a group of quite a number of small PDF files, which we consolidated.
You mean the UK Ministry of Defense?
UK Ministry of Defense, yeah.
Yeah, UK.
But what this is about is plasmas which appear, which are unknown to science, which have been appearing in our atmosphere for a very long time, and which affect the human mind. They cause people, as it says in the report, to believe things that did not happen. Now, this is incredibly important and profound, because if you look back across the history of mankind, many of the most important cultural interjections that have occurred because of the appearance of such lights. I refer most directly to Paul's experience on the road to Damascus. Now that we know they are there, and the Condon Report makes it perfectly clear that we do know that, it's not theoretical anymore, it's factual. Now that once that factual reality spreads into the general culture, then what you were talking about earlier is going to happen. The genius of mankind, which is not available behind the wall of classification, will take notice and will begin to understand that there is something there with which we have had and have a relationship that we have never understood, but that we can now. We lived for a long time, mankind, in a state of enchantment where we would look at the world around us and basically make up stories about why it was as it was. Then came the Enlightenment and a shift to the age of empiricism. And we rejected all of the enchantments. But what's going to happen now is the empirical vision is going to be re-enchanted in such a way that the enchantments are a concrete part of reality at last.
Well, is it because science can finally make sense of a lot of what used to be described as enchantment?
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Humanities will be extremely important because of the fact that the humanities, going back over history, will be able to tell us how we have seen this reality through the lens of enchantment, and that will enable us to understand how it wanted to be seen, and therefore give us a handle on what we're looking for scientifically. I've just finished a book with a good friend, Jeff Kripal, who is the chairman of the Department of Religion at Rice University, called Supernatural, two words, A New Vision of the Unexplained. It's going to come out from Tarcher Penguin next February 2016.
Oh, how wonderful.
And it is a re-envisioning of this whole area of the unknown. And it is unknown, but that doesn't mean it can't be understood, because it's there. It's there. And that process of expanding our vision is coming at the same time that the planet is becoming unable to hold on to us anymore, because we're simply too big. Mankind is a big baby ready to be born. And boy, I'm up for the birth. I think it's going to be terribly interesting. But I think also our cries are going to be mighty loud when the powers that be spank us and make us breathe true air of the new man's life.
Well, I have to tell you, my most current sort of feeling about what's going on in the world is I'm having such a profound sense of revulsion against the corporate leadership's vision for the United States that for many years I held out hope that there was a way to, you know, somehow come into alignment. But I finally realized that they are so completely, you know, their vision is so mediocre, and their approach, they're just so lost. It's almost as though we have no fundamental concept of the value of life.
Well, that's not just a corporate problem.
It's not just a what?
Not just a corporate problem. We don't have a fundamental value. We don't value life at all on this planet. It's been one of our problems for all of our time. I mean, we just came out of the upheaval that started with World War I and ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall, only to reach another level of much minor, milder upheaval in the Middle East. But we do not value life.
But I feel like I'm dealing with people who are so primitive in their thinking and their goals and their desires that you're almost talking about a different civilization.
Well, you are. I am talking about a different civilization. I'm talking about much more like the kind of civilization that was suggested by Teilhard de Chardin so many years
ago.
And I'm, you know, you and I are differ a bit in terms of corporate, the corporate level. It's easy to see problems with big corporations and their moral stance. But at the same time, a lot of companies look at it from the standpoint of a CEO, and he is trying to keep the lives of thousands of people going, of the people who work for him and who depend on his decisions in order for their lives to continue. So there is a level of fear there, especially facing change. And that level of fear makes some corporate leadership very venial. Other corporate leadership, it doesn't. Like Elon Musk is a very visionary guy. And, he runs a wonderful corporation. The people who run Google have the same kind of visionary spirit. And this is a very fertile world that these corporations like that are creating around themselves. And then you have...
You and I disagree mightily about Google, but
Google is Google is on the one hand a monster. When I often go very deeply into my computers to determine exactly what's going on in there. And one of the first things I always find are little things that Google's put into it without my knowledge that are there to enable Google to see what's going on. And I take them out. You'd be surprised.
Well, the reason I was bringing it up was I was reading last night on sort of the partnership between Gates and the cable industry, and sort of looking at this idea. I've been studying Common Core education, and you're basically talking about highly invasive surveillance systems, you know, first taking them into the adult world and then drilling them down into the child's world. And it's almost like a gold rush designed to, you know, steal life and invade privacy and steal every possible data stream you can from this process. And it's so, you know, it's almost demonic. And it's
very demonic.
And it's,
let's define, let's just say clearly here why privacy is so important. Privacy was not protected in the Bill of Rights because there was no reason to. No one had access. Privacy is the border around the individual. The habeas corpus in the long tradition in Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence protects the individual, but there was never a need to protect his privacy because generally people were in the past, they were just who they said they were. And their privacy was complete and absolute unless they were spied upon in some way by some inept way by a agent of the king or something. But invading that barrier causes us to lose our sense of individuality and our sense of individual presence and therefore also our personal life direction. It is very important to retain that boundary. And this is one of the things I disagree profoundly with Google about. I was talking about the way the corporate entity treated its workers. I wasn't talking about necessarily what it did in the outside world.
Right.
They don't get the fact that privacy is fundamental to Western culture because privacy is fundamental to the continued definition of the individual in his own mind. You know, my dad was a guy who was very much aware of all of these things. He used to say back in the 50s, why in the world does the state of Texas need to know whether or not I can drive a car? If I have a wreck, it's my fault and they should put me in jail. But it's not their business, and I don't want them having having me on their records. And I was working as a legislative assistant once in those very records, and I looked up my dad's records, and they weren't there. And I said to Dad, Dad, your birth certificate's not on file. He said, I know it. It's not on file. I can walk back in those records, too, just like you can. And I said, Dad, he said, privacy is basic. You don't have privacy, you don't have Western civilization. And Dad was right.
Well, here it's not just the compromise of privacy, but it's the combination of that invasion of privacy with entrainment technology and other invisible technology, you know, that compromises the financial well-being and the mind of the person. So when you invade privacy and you combine it with mind control that the recipient doesn't realize exists, you know, then you're talking about a whole level of disrespect, which has, you know, which I think is having a profound impact. So,
well, look, again, do you respect the chickens on the chicken farm? No, you do not. They are a commodity, and we are being turned into and re-envisioned as a commodity because that's the way to extract more money from us.
Right, and so I see that. You know, I see that as an unbelievably primitive attitude.
It's very primitive. It's very unformed and thoughtless and very prevalent.
And if you look at the, you know, a lot of the leadership of the software world and the cable world, you know, they're exceptionally primitive in their attitudes and their approach, and they think it's funny that they can get away with it.
That's right. There's a reason Uber is called Uber. You know, they look at themselves as overlords. That's why they spent so much time just ignoring the laws in so many different countries. And then putting out people who were supposed to be carefully vetted who weren't vetted at all. I wouldn't take an Uber car on a bet. I would not want I certainly don't want to be evaluated by the driver of the car, for God's sake. I mean, I'm paying him to drive me somewhere, and that's it. I don't even want him to know my name.
Right.
None of his business.
So it's a vision of the world which is so demonic. I just, you know, a kind of despair for, but it's one I want to get away from.
Well, you will get away from it. It's going to be pretty damn perky over the next few years. But in the end, this world that we live in now won't be here anymore, not in this form. Something else will emerge, and it's going to be very messy and very difficult. And in the end, when we look back, we will say to ourselves, how could we ever have lived like that?
Well, one thing before we end, Whitley, I would love to touch on the alien question because it's one I've never, I think you've heard the story of the one of the think tanks in Washington trying to persuade me that aliens exist and live among us and asking me if I wanted to have lunch with aliens. And I had this image of the National Enquirer with a headline, Fitz thinks she's lunching with aliens. And I said, you know, I'm just managing too much risk right now to be seen lunching with aliens. But I went through a process where they got me to read every book there was on the subject. And I'd already read Communion. But I could never make any sense of it. You know, it was just too... And I never met, you know, first of all, there's so much disinformation in the whole area that it's just designed to waste an enormous amount of time. But the other thing is I never met an alien story that I couldn't explain by mind control or, you know, something else. So there's no doubt it's an incredibly squiggly kind of area. And you get in, of course, to these issues of not just other planets, but parallel universes and,
yes,
you know, all sorts of other stuff. But needless to say, if you simply look at the phenomena as an economic phenomena or a technology phenomena, we're dealing with a pretty significant phenomena. And
well,
I'll never forget one of...
It is exquisitely accessible to confusion, believe me. Well, let me tell you...
Well, I don't know of a more intelligent, capable person who's... You know, there's you and Richard Dolan are the people I look to make sense of the whole thing. And maybe if you could just give us 5 minutes on where you think, you know, what does that mean to us in 2015? You know, if we want to have a great year this year, what does it mean to us this year? How do we deal with this phenomena?
Well, one thing I would suggest is if they do land on the White House lawn, sell your technology stocks right away.
they're
going to be quite an upheaval very soon.
Well, isn't a lot of Silicon Valley just that technology re-engineered into or reversed?
You know, I don't know. Let me tell you kind of where I'm anchored, because one of the difficulties of this, as you've alluded to, is finding any kind of an anchor for it in reality.
Right.
In May of 1989... two people entered my house, entered my bedroom while I was awake, and I heard a car come up into our gravel driveway, which was closed with a huge locked gate. And it was a May evening. The lights, the windows were open. It was about 11 o'clock. I immediately went to turn on the lights that surrounded the house. I could, with a flip of some switches on our wall, I could completely illuminate the whole area around the house. As I did that, I observed two people at the foot of coming into the room, a man and a woman. They were nearly at the foot of the bed by that time, coming very quickly. I had heard someone in the backyard as I came to consciousness, alerted by the sound of the gravel in the driveway. I heard someone say in the backyard, "Condition red." The two people were rushing toward me. I changed my idea and started going for the Benelli riot gun, which was fully loaded under the bed with big 12-gauge slugs. I mean, this thing was going to work. Instead, I ended up lying on my side, unable to see, but totally conscious, while pressure was being put from above on my left side of my head, waves of pressure. And the woman's voice was speaking very gently in words I don't remember. It ended very abruptly. I realized I could move. I heard crashing in the brush around the house. I may have heard the car leaving, but I was too busy jumping out of bed, grabbing, now this time, a pistol. I mean, you can imagine that somebody had been through what I'd been through would be rather heavily armed, and I was. And the house, by the way, was completely enclosed in alarm systems. There were, and it was absolutely on, and it was on while they were in the house, red armed, no question, right beside the bed, visible. I ran through the house seeking any opening, did not find a thing. I finally went back to my bedroom and I thought to myself, now this is fantastic. This, if this wasn't, was a dream, it was the most vivid dream you could have. But I was helpless. I didn't know what to do, and I sure as hell didn't plan to go outside. There was no way I was going hunting for them in the night. You can be sure, if they were there. So I kind of sort of fitfully slept through the night, got up the next morning, told my wife about it. She hadn't noticed a thing. And then I went out to get the papers, which entailed in that place, driving down to the foot of a hill about a mile and a half away and buying the newspapers and then riding back up to the house, which I did every morning. I opened the door into the garage. The garage door itself was alarmed, and the windows, everything was alarmed. There was a door from the house into the garage that was not alarmed. Opened the door, and the garage door was wide open, and the alarm system was still armed. So I disarmed it, got in the car, started to back out, and was greeted by an explosion of static electricity in the car, so intense, everything was popping, little miniature lightning bolts were flying all over the place, and I jumped out of the car, I thought it was going to explode, and it didn't. So then I called the alarm man and said, come over here, something's weird going on with my alarm system. And he came over and he found the system was intact, working perfectly. There had been an opening in the system at about 11:53 in the night. Something had opened, had come through it, had not triggered the alarm for unknown reasons. The switch in the garage door had a powerful magnetic field around it. Now, and this is what had kept it from snapping open and triggering the alarm. The problem with this is, there's no such thing as a magnetic field that is propagated. It's not, they're not like radio waves. They are a field around a magnet. It's not a wave. In other words, it doesn't go out into the atmosphere. So where was it coming from? There was no explanation for it. It just was there. So he took the switches off and threw them out, put new switches on, and it worked fine after that. Later that afternoon, my ear began to hurt. I reached up and touched it, and there was something there in my ear, which I am touching right now. A while later, I finally found a doctor 2 years later in Texas who would deal with it. I lied to him and told him it was a cyst, but, you know, he'd read Communion, he'd read all my work, he knew it wasn't a cyst. But he would do it anyway. The others would all say, no, I can't touch it. And so he opened it up. And he said, and this is on a video that's on my website, by the way. He said, I'm looking at a white disc, and there's something, I'm not sure exactly what I'm looking at. This, I've never seen anything like it before. He attempted to remove it, and when he did, it shot down into my earlobe on its own. He got a little piece of it, which he sent to a lab, and they reported that it was a metallic base with living motile cilia on it. And they said it was not natural. It was a technological object. A few days later, it came back up to where it remains in my ear to this day. That was put into me by people. It turned on once when I was at the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, a lot of sophisticated equipment there. They took me into a signals acquisition lab. Whether they found anything or not, I don't know, because most of what the lab did was classified. So they couldn't tell me whether or not they found any detected a signal. So they said that they thought that whatever signal they might have detected was interfered by radars from the nearby airport. And that was that. The object is there to this day. Every once in a while, it turns on. I feel heat in my ear. The ear will turn bright red. There's a grinding sort of whining sound, and eventually it will fade away. That is why I know there is somebody very human right here in possession of technology that is far beyond anything that is available off the shelf.
Right. I've had, not that experience, but I've had other kinds of experience, invisible man technology, other kinds of experience that says the same thing. And, you know, what's interesting is if you always come back to the challenges in the economy, it always comes back to the fact that you have a group that's acting, you know, above the law with impunity. And that is exactly what's behind the centralization of control of wealth and ownership. And it's, you know, that vise on the economy is in many respects destroying different parts of the economy.
Well, yeah, we've discussed before there's a tremendous amount of wealth being siphoned off into this.
Right. Well, it's not just the wealth that's being siphoned off. It's the wealth that's being destroyed, because what is happening is you're shrinking the pie to make sure you have centralized control. But the dysfunction that comes from the lies and the lawlessness is very destructive of wealth. And I think you're seeing a level of lawlessness and lies that are just very oppressive on everybody. And that's why I think transparency can help a lot, because
transparency is essential. You know that, right? John Podesta on February the 15th tweeted that his greatest regret upon leaving the White House as a presidential advisor was that he had not been able to get them to come clean on the whole alien UFO thing. And he added, it's the law. And they are violating the law by keeping all of this stuff secret. And it's why I can't say, yes, it's this and yes, it's that. What I can tell you is what is anchored in my body. I can theorize about the other stuff, but who cares? Everyone's heard all those theories, and we don't know, just pouring from the empty into the void. We need facts.
Yeah, we need facts, and they're challenging to get. So before we close, what I would love you to do is give us a description of your website and your services, because yours is one place we can go for for a real effort, an honest, authentic effort to come up with a framework, at least to deal with the uncertainty. So,
unusual information you can rely on. Well, my website.
And I have to agree with you. I think the most important sort of trend going on is whatever is happening with geophysical weather and the planet. And one of the reasons I don't highlight it more in the annual report, every annual review I say that, you know, the changes in the weather is one of the most important phenomena, but I struggle to get clear, honest information. Of course, that's not my background. So I really thank you for highlighting that, because I think there is no more important trend to understand. And I know there's a lot at your website. Anyway, so I interrupted. Yep. Walk us through what's available.
My website's called unknowncountry.com, and it has daily news on it, usually a story at the edge of science. We don't really go off into the unsupportable. So when you read something there, there's some reason to believe it may be true. And Whitley's Journal is there, and in my journal I comment very extensively on the same subjects that we've been talking on here. There is a vast archive of news and a sophisticated search engine available on the site, so you can really play with it and get a lot of news going back to 1999, it was 1999 when Ann Streber founded the site. And we became a daily news site on 9/11, actually, and have stayed a daily news site ever since. Now, you can also listen to Dreamland, my weekly radio show. And if you don't subscribe to the site, you can listen to the first 30 minutes of Dreamland every week. You can download it, and you'll have some commercials in it. But if you subscribe, then you listen to the full hour of Dreamland with no commercials, and often there will be additional special interviews. There's also a wonderful program about close encounters called The Experience, run by Jeremy Vaney, who has extremely sophisticated ideas about the whole phenomenon that go beyond the usual aliens from another planet are here studying us or stealing our sperm and eggs or whatever it is. So, it's actually, I mean, that's an aspect of it. It's not, it's there.
Right, I know.
But, you know, it's all there. It's all there. It one of the things about this phenomenon, you soon realize that every single claim about it, no matter how bizarre, is in one way or another supported in a manner that is going to make you wonder what the hell's going on. So,
well, there's no doubt about it. What's going on in this planet is so weird.
It's weird.
It's weird. I mean, and that's what I'll never forget. One of the most important moments of insight I've ever had was I had the opportunity to do a coast-to-coast show up in Vancouver with you and Anne, and I went on first, and then you went on after the intermission, and you were being interviewed by George. And, you know, I love the coast-to-coast audience because they are so smart and curious, and, you know, it's just a very lively group of people. And so there was a Q&A session, and somebody asked you, do any of the movies about the alien question really convey what it's like to, you know, to be with, you know, with this phenomenon?
Be with them? And, no, nothing does and nothing can. Because
right. Well, what you said was you were very quiet for a long time, and you were clearly struggling. And you said, "No, they really don't." And she said, "Why?" And you really thought and thought and thought. And I thought, "No, this is a man of extraordinary intellectual integrity. He's really trying to figure out how to communicate." And I should just point out, Communion was made into a very, you know, talent, well produced, well acted movie. So this included your movie as well. And so.
Yeah.
You, after quite a long time, you said, there are no words in the English language to explain to you how weird it feels.
You know, I can actually add to that now. And the reason, the reason is that you're not in this reality. You're in a half.
A parallel.
A kind of, not in a parallel universe, but you're between worlds. You're not, and some of the physics of where you are is different from this physics. So,
well, that's what I thought when I heard you. I said, what he's expressing is dealing with something where the electromagnetics are so different than what we're used to that it's basically expanding your electromagnetics somehow.
Expanding. You're in a different level of reality of yourself. Because, you know, as I alluded to earlier, we are not what we seem to ourselves, even.
Right.
We're living in a the brain is not the seat of consciousness, it's the filter of consciousness. And
right.
When we understand that, we begin to understand also why all of this high strangeness around us isn't so strange, and why we actually do know much of what's going on. We're pretending that we don't. We're this is a stage. It really is. Shakespeare was right, and we are actors acting out on the stage. And the brain.
It's funny. I was with a very dear friend for a couple of weeks as she was dying, and I was with her when she died, and it was as though I entered into a whole. You know, she was shifting into a different dimension, and it was as though I had entered into a halfway house with her. And I could see and feel and experience the other side. And it was very, you know, it was stretching my electromagnetics is the only thing I can say.
Fascinating.
Well, Whitley, we have so much to talk about, but this conversation draw us to a close, but maybe we need to do another one.
Yeah, well, I'm always up for it. We can keep going. And I want to thank you. And, you know, my listeners are going to hear this too. And the Solari Report is a wonderful operation. And the Solari Report 2015, you'll understand if you subscribe to the Solari Report why it's so valuable when you get this annual document. It's really, really
Do you
good.
Ever went on your website, do you ever put up your take on where the equity markets or other markets are going as it relates to some of the phenomena you're studying?
No, I haven't ever done that, but it's a good idea. I think I will.
I think it is a good idea. It is a good idea.
Yeah, I will do
okay,
it.
Okay, well, Whitley, maybe that's what we should discuss on our next conversation. What does all this mean to the commodities, the equities, the fixed income markets, the global debt? I would love to do that.
Okay, wonderful. Let's do it.
Okay. Okay, Whitley Strieber, thank you so much. You have a wonderful day.
Well, you too.